on ASL 2089. It deals with the Department of Housing and Community Services related to debt service. Ms. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. House Bill 2089 increases the statutory limit on outstanding revenue bond debt. This will enable Housing and Community Services Department to maintain its programs at the projected levels they expect to exceed the current bond limit of $1.03 billion sometime during the middle of the upcoming biennium. Excuse me. Although passage of this bill will allow the department to issue more revenue bonds, before they can issue any bonds, it has to be included in the bond authorization bill, which this session is Senate Bill 5002. And, of course, that bill has to be approved by the Legislative Assembly. This bill was heard by the agency, House Agency Performance and Operations Committee, and has already passed the House. It was referred here by the Senate Legislative Fiscal Office recommending approval of the bill.
Is there any questions by committee members? Committee?
Mr. Chairman, can this increase from $1 billion to $2 billion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, that is correct.
And how are these bonds to be repaid? Is it repaid by revenue?
Yes.
The revenue bonds.
They're revenue bonds.
So it's repaid from the revenue from the program.
And what is the collateral for the bonds?
The housing development units that they use to build, use the money to build affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And so the resources from those projects are the assets themselves, the buildings and apartment units and those sorts of things are the collateral, and the revenue from those properties are used to repay the bonds. Mm-hmm.
Another question.
Yeah.
So in case of default of payment, the assets are the collateral. Okay. Maybe I'm asking a question.
Brandon, if you'd like to come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Lynn Scheffler, for the record, Deputy Director of the Housing and Community Services Department. To respond to Senator Yee's question, indeed, the assets, the physical assets, either the apartment project or the single family home, which has a mortgage on it, is collateral for the bonds, and in addition, we have mortgage insurance. So in the case of default, there's both the physical asset itself as well as mortgage insurance.
So the payments are due once the bonds are sold, but if the housing are not completed yet, so those assets are really not worth very much. So if there's a default during the construction is made, then what kind of collateral do they receive?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, two situations. On the first-time home buyers, the single-family mortgage program, the houses are in existence when we issue the mortgages, so they are in existence at the time the bonds are issued. On the other side, on the multifamily housing, on the apartment project, when we issue the bonds, we invest the bonds, or the proceeds of the bonds, until that housing project is actually built, and then we issue the mortgage. So the cash assets from the bond issuance is sitting in a bank in investments. In case the project isn't built, we can tap into those cash resources and repay the bonds if necessary. But what we do in issuing those bonds is we provide notice of more projects that are eligible to be financed than we actually issue bonds for. So if a project drops out along the way, we have another replacement project in line to step in and take the proceeds of those bonds.
So the payment is guaranteed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, in essence, we provide enough safeguards that if the bonds aren't executed in a mortgage, the cash is sitting there available to repay the bond, but we do want to use the proceeds on mortgages, and so we have more than one housing project lined up to use those bond proceeds.
I think Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I just had a concern as to whether or not this was in fact a general obligation. I assume it's not a general obligation bond issued, but they are in fact have the security from the revenue sources. They become revenue bonds, in effect.
Representative Schrader, just a question on, I assume this is within prudent guidelines of investment and all that sort of thing. Won't get into the same problem we did with the veterans bonds back in the 1980s, and we have more collateral in the case.
If I can give you a little bit of history, the reason we got in trouble in the 80s in the VA was that we were borrowing at 8% and lending it out at 5%. And this doesn't occur that way.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely accurate. We don't loan money at less than our borrowing costs, on the record.
That statute has been a long time ago. Yes, Senator Lynn.
Is this going to affect in any way about the rate in our state? We are trying to move up from the, from, I think we are trying to move up to the average. A triple A, if possible, from the triple A at this time. How is it going to affect that? It's increased to $800 million more, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, the authority is provided by this bill, but it doesn't actually authorize the issuance of the bonds. That issuance of the bonds is very closely metered and monitored by the Treasurer's Office. So if indeed we were to issue bonds that would in any way jeopardize that or be contemplating issuing bonds that would indeed jeopardize the face rating, the Treasurer would prohibit us from issuing those bonds. These are bonds are always issued consistent with the standards and the fiscal status of the state that doesn't impair the state's bond rating.
Yes, if I could help you, Senator, the question you just asked, Lynn, and I think your response, boy, what the Senator was asking. 5502, the Senate bill, is the one that authorizes the release or sale of the bonding. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's right.
And I think that's his question is, what is this bill different from 5502 in the fact that it authorizes the sale and release of these bonds and then this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, the current limitation, the $1.03 billion, was established back in 1981, and so we have been operating within that limitation for the last 18 years. What this bill raises that bar and establishes a new limitation, but as Senator Hannon indicates, the House Bill 5002, the bond bill, meters the annual allocation of or allocation allotment of bond issuance authority. So even though we're raising the bar substantially, the state bond bill only lets us issue so much annually, and it will take us several years to reach that limitation proposed by this bill.
Here, please.
I have some information concerning the oversaturation or about low cost of housing, and then without comprehensive study, they just did it. Now, suddenly we find that we have more low-cost housing available in certain areas. Does the bonding have to do with it at all, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, bonding has something to do with it, yes. But when we do issue bonds, those proceeds are used to write mortgages for the housing project. A part of underwriting that mortgage is taking a look at what's the community's need for affordable housing. And if we find that there's already a saturation situation like you're describing, we will not approve that project.
And who studies those things? Sometimes it happened already in a certain area. We find more low-cost housing than what we need. Then the commercial development has to come into a conflict with it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynn, when we underwrite a proposed project, we contract with an independent appraiser and market study individual to provide us a third-party opinion of their view of what the local market is. So we don't do it ourselves, and we don't allow the project sponsor to do that themselves. We seek a third independent party to give us presumably an independent view of the community.
Thank you.
The floor is Further questions? If not, we'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2089.
Move passage of House Bill 2089, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler moves House Bill 2089, Department of Housing and Community Services related to the debt service, to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Could I have clarification? Where does it say this is a revenue bond and not general obligation bond?
1B.
1B?
Line 10.
1B?
Line 10 on the first page.
Line 10. Non-general obligation. And I suppose 456550 relates to a revenue bond?
Correct.
Is that what it is, revenue bond?
Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Lee?
Aye.
Lynn?
Aye.
Schrader?
Aye.
Butler?
Aye.
Catherine?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Cannon?
Aye. The motion passes. Who would like to carry it on the House side? Representative Schrader? Senator Lim, would you like to carry it on the Senate side?
Yes.
And
it's already passed the House.
Oh, it doesn't have to go back for concurrence or
full committee then.
Okay, just the full committee, I can carry it the full committee and Senator Lim can carry it on the Senate side.
You can carry it on the full?
Yeah, on the full, that's fine. Okay, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2089. And open the public hearing on House Bill 5015, the Economic Development Department. And the chair would announce right now that it should be our attention if we can get excused and the committee the first 20 to 30 minutes of the floor session. We're going to try to wrap up this presentation in a little quicker manner so we can move towards closure next week and
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, related to that, I did pass out a weekly agenda, so if you're interested in what's going to be on next week, it's listed there.
Okay. Mr. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bill Scott, the Director of the Oregon Economic Development Department. I think we're passing out two items. One is an answer to from the Christine Garcy to questions in her testimony yesterday. The other is a couple of pages of brief descriptions of the program line items that Representative Schrader asked for earlier in the week. Unfortunately, as I was looking this over this morning, I noticed that we had not included the federally funded programs in that, and we will provide you a supplement on data. Today, what we're going to do is continue with the Community Development Fund, which is the largest single line item in our budget. And if you go to the green tab that says Community Development Fund about halfway through the book. The first page behind that, I've already been through this. You can skip to the third page, and remember we're looking at the shaded portion of the lottery program. This is where all the program option packages are, and today we're basically going to review for you the overall inventory of needs that we've done that supports most of those program option packages. Specifically, if you go to the next page, and you'll recall on page four that the fund, in the way the commission has structured it following the work group, what we're going over today is that portion that represents the planned financing of projects that we control centrally that we call statewide investments. All funds in that we control centrally are managed by our finance team, whose manager is Yvonne Addington. And Yvonne is here with me today and will be making this presentation. What she's going to do is essentially overview a little bit of the history of where these programs came from and in general why we have them, and then to give you a status report or progress report on a project we've been working on that really stems from requests from previous legislators wanting to see the big picture of need that's out there that these programs are trying to meet. And she'll be speaking primarily from the white tab, third from the back, that says needs inventory. So,
Mr. Chairman of the committee, if it's been helpful, the agency has distributed, and you have in front of you, a sheet that has definitions of what is included in the community development fund. It looks like this.
That's the one I just referred to that we just passed out.
Right. And the definitions of what we're going to be talking about today is under number four. Second page.
Okay, Yvonne.
Okay. I'm Yvonne Addington. I'm manager of the finance team in the Oregon Economic Development Department. I have spent my entire state career of 15 years developing programs for infrastructure and community facilities at the local level. And the reasons for that are sometimes not so apparent, the reasons why we need infrastructure and community facilities. Without adequate water, wastewater treatment, community facilities, docks, airports, and all the other infrastructure needed to get people to work and products to market, we could not have a significant job development and community development within the city. The second reason for us, the state, to be interested in infrastructure is that the state does rely on the income taxes created by the jobs, and the businesses do need necessary infrastructure in order to maintain production. They need basic water for fire pressures and putting out the fires, and for developing their projects. They need wastewater treatment. They need streets, airports, things like that to get their products to market. The legislature has done a lot of work in developing these programs, and certainly we are ahead of the many other states in the United States in providing financial incentives and financial assistance for infrastructure. And we began participating in this in 1983 when the federal government gave the states the block grant program. The good news was there were grants for low and moderate income communities. The bad news was the rest of the people the rest of the communities that were not composed of low and moderate income people did not have a source of money. So when the lottery came in, the legislature developed the Special Public Works Fund. This is about 1985-86, one of the first lottery programs. And at that time, the economy was not so great. And so, and most of the communities did not have water, sewer, or roads out to the industrial parks where we needed to be recruiting businesses or expanding business. So that program was created to extend necessary infrastructure to the businesses to create the jobs. Then it became apparent that some of the communities didn't have any infrastructure to offer to locate their businesses, so we started building capacity with reservoirs and things like that. There were so many needs identified that we had to become quite innovative. We created the Oregon Bond Bank, which allows the department to pool the local government's financial needs into one bond issue and sell revenue bonds. It's called the Oregon Bond Bank. And the purpose, of course, is to stretch the Special Public Works, water, wastewater, lottery dollars provided. So we're able to, it's been a very innovative program, and we have a very good national reputation. What we do is take five or six communities, sometimes 10, package their financial needs for a water or sewer plant, and sell the revenue bond and in the market and generate more money for projects. We used the lottery dollars to pay the issuance costs, to buy any grants and make any loans that we have to do. Just yesterday we sold, day before yesterday, sold $7 million in bonds. We got 5.1% interest for five communities. That's much lower than they can get on their own, so we're saving the cities and communities $2.9 million over 20 years on just that $7 million issue for five communities. The bottom line is the tax, the property owner does not have to pay such high water rates, and in many communities that is very significant. We try to keep the water rates down to $32 a month. That's the statewide average. Some of them are facing $85 a month if we don't help them. In order to stretch our money, we also participate with the federal government and all the other state agencies that provide in any way regulation of water, wastewater, community facilities. We meet once a month and with any local government to describe or to discuss their project and what needs to be done to help them finance it. Therefore, we're working together with our partners to finance it. Sometimes it's so expensive, $3 to $5 million for even a community of 500 population for a water system, and another $3 million for sewers. But it takes all of us with federal and state money to fund the project.
Yes, Representative Butler.
I just had one question relative to the water and infrastructure programs relative to the cities that we're talking about. Number one, do these cities, when we provide them this assistance, do they have strict covenants that they're going to provide it only to the city limits and no further? And number two, are there opportunities for them to expand their water systems, both water and sewer, outside of even potentially their growth boundaries, so that they could provide the water into other areas where they may be having difficulties with nitrates or septic and health issues? I need to know how proactive we are in that regard.
Answer is that we do work with our fellow state agencies. We do allow water and wastewater to be extended to the urban growth boundary, outside the city, but in the urban growth boundary, and only upon case by case do we allow infrastructure to be extended outside the urban growth boundary. There is a case, Adana and Detroit, I think are the two cities up the canyon here, who will share a joint wastewater system with a state park that is outside the urban growth boundaries, but the Department of Land Conservation puts strict restrictions on the pipe in
And I guess the second question I have in regard to that is that if it is done on a case-by-case basis, do we, in the restrictions or covenants on these projects, are we encouraging cities and counties to be proactive to seek out those opportunities to provide those opportunities to utilize these bonds and to try and then I guess it really gets back to the question, why if we've got a safety issue, do you just go to the 25-year-old or 20-year-old UGV?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, our department, the Community Solutions team process has been great for this. Our department finds itself often in the kind of the mediator role here because the Department of Environmental Quality, by virtue of their mission, tends to want to extend water and sewer everywhere. The Department of Land Conservation and Development, by virtue of their mission, tends to want to be quite restrictive about it. The local interests may fall all over the place in a given situation, and we're usually the ones that have to get everybody in the room and say, how are we going to settle this? And frankly, I think that process of, I guess I'd say, sitting down informally and trying to find the win-win that that can meet everybody's objectives and all the missions that the legislature has given to the different departments. I think it's beginning to be something that we're collectively getting more and more skilled at, although obviously each situation is different and some of them are quite challenging. But to answer your question, we aren't being doctrinaire about exactly what's possible, and I think that land conservation and development is, you know, has got a fair amount of flexibility within their statute and rules, as long as the intent of the law to prevent wasteful sprawl is being addressed by the solution, that there are ways to avoid a silly result that would not allow us to solve a health problem.
So these, Mr. Chair, final question. These are not laws, statutory laws, as much as they are perhaps administrative rules and just pure bureaucracy in some of the departments.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowen, no, I wouldn't use those words. I would say there are standards both in the statute and in the rules. I think the standards provide enough flexibility that in most cases a sensible solution can be worked out.
Mr. Chair, there's a concern, and the reason I raise this, and I don't mean to belabor the food problem, because it is a problem. We have in Eastern Oregon, we have a high nitrates problem, and immediately outside of our growth boundary areas, very, very high nitrates, and the city water and city sewer are a few blocks away, but outside of the urban growth boundaries, or some of us within the urban growth boundary, others just immediately extend beyond. Largest meat packing processor and Ontario, Oregon area is right at the edge of it, with a complete mobile home park. On the other side of that, we just need to have some regulations or at least the flexibility. If these are statutory, then we need to be able to go on the outside of those, or if they're administrative rules, that we at least stop and take a look at the issue of health issues relative to, and we're not talking about the mobile home park, which is right next to the city limits. We're talking about the mobile home park that lays at the other end of the golf course there, where children cannot be, where families legally cannot move in. You must be over 80 years old to move in on the last rows of dying or pretty close to it, so that the water won't hurt you because of the high nitrates. My nitrates are higher than theirs.
There's an issue here that you're bringing out, and it's what is statutory and what is administratively determined. And I think you have to look at the community solution team as an attempt to address some of those things. Right now in Jackson County, we have City of Ashland, the urban growth boundary, and then the state highway wanting to put in a rest area. The city has agreed to arbitrarily extend its line to the rest area across the property of an applicant who wants to build a golf course, and the state is telling the golf course you can't have water because you're outside the urban growth boundary, but it's all right for the rest area. So it's a screwed up catch-22, and I think that Mr. Scott is trying to say, when is it statutorily, when is it administratively, it's on an individual case-by-case situation rather than one-size-fits-all.
Mr. Chairman, I'm probably out of my depth speaking to statutes that are administered by other departments. Maybe I should confine my answer to saying there's nothing in the statutes that authorize our financing programs that requires us to be rigid about
excellent.
These
Thank
things.
Thank you very much. Yeah. That's important right there.
Okay.
If we've got that portion, then usually, as Mr. Scott has indicated, they are the catalyst. The economic development.
Bring all these parts.
Bring them together.
Yeah. Okay. Yvonne?
Okay. Now I'm going to get into how bad is it and how much money is needed, and I can refer you to the inventory, the needs inventory. It's the very back of your notebook, and it's a green report called called Inventory of Local Infrastructure. It contains...
Where's that?
The very back of the book.
The third tab from the back.
Oh.
The third tab from the back, white tab.
It says needs inventory.
It's got a green cover on it.
Yeah.
It
looks like this. Yeah. You just passed it. She has the green cover and bath. Right there.
Okay.
It's a sideways book.
Sideways book. Sorry for that. And we've been collecting data for some time and showing worthwhile projects, gathering them on the list to finance them, as have our federal partners, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Rural Development, which provides the most federal dollars for infrastructure in the small communities. And finally, we decided it was time to inventory all of the cities, counties, and especially in the rural area, which was our target by the legislature in the last session. So about the same time as we started asking the local governments indicate what their infrastructure.
Can you tell me what you're defining as, what OEDB defining as rural, what do you define as rural area versus?
Yes, I'm talking about, thank you for asking that, I'm talking about rural communities inside urban growth boundaries of rural communities, and mainly outside the metropolitan areas of Portland, Salem, Springfield, Eugene, and Medford. The rural communities, as opposed to extending service into the rural agricultural area. Okay. We asked local governments to talk to us about their four-year needs coming up in 4 years. And on, at about the same time, the League of Oregon Cities inventoried their cities for their needs. And then the counties inventory their needs for community facilities. The results coming back on the rural communities was a need in the next 4 years for $1 billion worth of inventory of infrastructure. The cities survey was a partial survey of urban and rural communities that came back at $1 billion for their needs. And the counties came back with $0.7 billion, pretty close to $0.8 billion for community facilities, which are basically fire and life safety, police and fire, and corrections and buildings like that. That is shown on page one, page I of the green report for that, the third page in. So the estimated 4 to 5 year need again. $1 billion for rural infrastructure, $1 billion for urban, and about $0.7 billion for county community facilities. The two-year shortfall came in about $100 million, and the proposal for in our program option package covers about one-fifth of that shortfall. The conclusion was that we did put in, the governor did put in the option package in the 99-2001 budget of $55 million. Again, that's shown on I. The total needs of these projects were kind of divided down, so you can see where the biggest issue was. Now I'm on II, or 2, Roman numeral 2. Mostly for drinking water systems and wastewater treatment systems, and that's caused by more regulations, more federal and state regulations, also in increased costs. These drinking water, wastewater issues are not going to go away, so there's no way you can get rid of them, and the communities are going to have to do it one way or the other. The majority of us...
Excuse me, I love the passage.
Do you have any idea which of those were state mandates and which of those were federal mandates? Do you have any idea? I mean, I understand a lot of the federal stuff, but I wasn't aware that there was a lot of state stuff except for coming compliance with the feds that we were doing that was going to drive the cost on local communities. And so I'm wondering if you can point me to any of that, or if it because I was aware of a lot of the federal stuff, so I'm just trying to...
We don't separate that out. The State Health Department and the Department of Environmental Quality do enforce many of the federal laws.
Right.
And I would not have an idea. I could ask them if they could tell me that.
I'd just be interested if we've got some state laws that we're passing that are so much more obvious. I mean, I think the federal laws are reasonably tight for a lot of local communities, and I know that there's some substantial investments that local communities are having to make as a result of this, but I wasn't aware that there were state laws that are driving some of the infrastructure needs, and as we look at that as a whole, I'd like to know from my perspective how much we're driving that through our process.
My basic feeling is that they're mostly enforcing the federal safe drinking water standards that have recently been enacted, and the Clean Water Act, which is the wastewater going into the streams and rivers, both federal. And when we make our decisions for grants and loans, we require a letter showing what the compliance issues are. But we don't separate them out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, I just comment that the reason we always say state and federal is because the way our legislation is written, it's in the water wastewater fund is to finance needs that are driven by state or federal regulations. I'm not aware of any situation that's been brought to my attention where we're doing something more extensively because of state regulation than federal regulation would require. We'll check with our state agency partners and see if that is a correct answer. But that's never been brought to my attention.
That's what I thought. So that's what I just asked. If you want to say state, federal, that's what I was asking. You want to continue, please.
Okay. On page 4, briefly, it is an analysis of the shortfall and talks about all of the available resources that we gather, which are shown at the bottom of page 4, and then the local effort, which is about 40% bonds and everything else, which leaves that shortfall I was talking about of about $100 million in the next 2 years for infrastructure. Page 5 is a summary that shows where we got those numbers in every county. They represent water districts, sewer districts, cities, counties, tribes in doing that. And then behind that, by county, is every project that is included in the survey. So for your area, you can check and see what the needs are that we represent. It also helps us to start addressing how we can allocate these scarce resources and kind of get ahead of the curve to know what we have to anticipate.
I have a general question or concern on the community facilities portion. I looked glancing through the book at just about any conceivable community facilities in here. I guess I'd like some direction from the committee and maybe from the department on where we're going with this. To me, this is the Economic Development Department. And the community facilities that I would suspect that we were trying to fund through this particular agency and the bond proceeds in particular should relate in some way to economic development. And I'm just concerned that the mission of the whole department is going to shift away from its original mission, which was to help promote business development and growth. And I'm very, very concerned. I look here on page III, and I look under the urban category, only a third of the money they're requesting is for general community facilities. My own county is guilty as everybody else. We've got justice centers in there and courthouses. We need that. We definitely need it. But I think it's time to set some policy about how far down this road we go and with the interest of the department's input in our committee's input.
What is
triple I? It's in the green report.
That's in the green report.
I was
going to
say
it's in the package. It's item 3. Not the item, just item 3. You want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schrader, I believe basically the legislature has set policy in this area basically in two different ways. One is that I think the mission creep you've expressed fears about has already occurred in the sense that you've changed our name to the Department of Economic and Community Development, and I think recognize how much of the financing we do is not directly related to shorter-term job creation. However, the good news from the point of view of your question is that the legislature in 1997 authorized and in this session slightly modified the authority that we have to finance community facilities other than infrastructure, which is very limited, and essentially we can only provide loans or transaction costs for organizing bond sales, and the whole impetus for this came from the Association of Oregon Counties, which wanted to take advantage of the Oregon Bond Bank mechanism that we have in order to, so that we could pool local government community facilities projects of any kind, and all the ones you suggested, city halls, courthouses, fire stations, or whatever, we can pool those and take them to Wall Street the way we do for water and sewer projects under the authority that we now have. And what we didn't have until this session, and if this budget is passed, is essentially the ability to, well, we had the authority to do it, but we didn't have any ability to essentially advance the money that's required to make it happen. But this is, there's no significant use of lottery, it's a very minor use of lottery resources. It's just essentially administrative costs and legal fees involved in organizing the bond sale.
Yes, but in the looking at the bond package, we have it in our document handed out, the described the different categories, mm-hmm. definitions you handed out. It's also in our book. But when I look at the bond sale as at least listed here, I know it's been modified in subcommittee, and hopefully we get a chance to modify it here. For $55 million, $3 million is allocated in the community facilities, for community facilities out of that. That would sound like more than just to administer, you know, and get the thing going. Sounds like there's matching money, I assume, in there, or some extra.
The $3 million probably would cover if a group of cities came in for a building project. It would cover a loan that is our share of the risk to the bonds that we sell. It's packaging and bolstering the bond sale. So that if something went wrong with the bond, we would be responsible for ponying up that loan before they would...
A small subordinated loan.
It's a small subordinated loan. So we would be paying issuance costs for legal fees and financial fees and packaging the loan, selling the bond, and providing loans for our share of the risk. But that money returns to us. We're not talking about grant dollars here.
Final question.
Yes.
So how much is that $3 million leverage then?
Representative Schrader, the leverage on the Oregon Bond Bank has been about $4 for every $1 that we are loaning of our own money and paying issuance costs. Sometimes it's better if we get a big city in with the little cities and the rates are better. We do a little better than that, 1 to 5 sometimes. But it's very significant savings to the locals for passing on the low interest rates, and it's very significant.
Representative Scott.
And Mr. Scott stated we've already changed the name, and this is no longer economic development. Department of Technology Development and Community Development.
Representative Patridge?
That's where
I'm
going through.
Okay. All right. Any other further questions?
I have a question on the community facilities also. I understand that it used to be $3 million to help with housing rehabilitation, help the houses to be rehabilitated to suit the seniors or the residents' needs. The cost is a lot more effective when you help them with housing rehabilitation rather than build new house for the low-income citizens. So why is this money being cut from $3 million to $1.5 million? This is what I heard from Constitution.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, the senator is referring to the Community Development Block Grant Program, the department's proposed allocation for the 1999 program year, which is now being circulated for public comment. We have consistently allocated a portion of the federal block grant, which can be used for a wide variety of community development purposes, a portion of it to make grants to municipalities to fund revolving loan funds that do local revolving loan funds that do provide loans for rehabilitation of single family houses. And the proposal, as the senator stated, this year is to increase the allocations to public works and community facilities and decrease on a one-year basis the amount for housing rehabilitation. The reason for it is partly driven by our perception of the relative demand, but more than that, it's really driven by a desire on our part and the part of the Department of Housing and Community Services to take a hard look at the housing rehab portion of it and see if we can't redesign it to come up with a much more, I guess I would say, highly leveraged program that instead of loaning public dollars one way or another encourages banks and financial institutions to make these rehab loans and provide some kind of public support through insurance or guarantee mechanisms to do it so that we get more bang for the buck and can rehab more houses. We're also trying to encourage a revision of the system that would, I guess I would say, reduce the number of revolving loan programs so that we could have a smaller number of lenders, or I guess I would say, or program operators that would have the ability to develop more expertise and administer the loans more efficiently. The way this program has been run is really a very high overhead administrative cost program that for the amount of public dollars being invested doesn't get as much housing rehabilitation done as we think it should. So what we're proposing is that we take the next year to jointly with the Department of Housing and Community Services, we look at the program and then we hope we can come up with a model that we can provide some fairly dramatic increase in the amount of rehabilitation going on for the same dollars. Okay. So that's the rationale for our current proposal.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that it is a lot more cost effective to rehabilitate an old home rather than build new buildings. So do you have statistics that can show what does it cost per unit to build a new housing compared to what does it cost to fix an old home? Because sometimes if you help them with a new roof or help them with setting up a ramp so that they can use their wheelchair and still maintain a home is a lot more cost effective, and you can help the rural residents a lot more that way rather than to force them to move to town where the new apartment buildings are. Do you have those statistics so we can make a comparison? I understand there is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, no, we don't have the statistics. I know that Director Repine agrees very much with your point of view, and I I would guess that their department could provide some kind of statistics, and maybe we'll ask them to help us with that. That's one of the reasons we're really trying to get them to involved in looking at this and probably in administering whatever program comes out of it, because we think they're better positioned to make those kind of comparisons since they do both things they're involved, and I think they agree that they'd like to be putting more resource into rehabilitation in relation to construction of new housing.
Well, I thought you must have those data in your hands when you recommend to cut that funding in half. You must have those data for an evaluation before you recommend reducing the funding to half of it. And I understand the advisory committee is no longer in existence, because those advisory committees should be able to advise you that this is really not a cost-effective way to go. And I understand the rules are not going to be going through public hearing until June. Usually the rules the year before were adopted in previous October, so the cities can come in and apply those loans by January. Now you're not going to adopt rules until June, so you're about 6 or 7 months late. And by the time the cities apply for this funding, they're going to miss a whole construction season. Why are you so late, and why do you eliminate the advisory committee that can help you make good decisions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, if you'll remember the last legislative session in your subcommittee in a budget note, endorsed the new directions proposed by the Economic Development Commission and created an interim work group whose report is in the front of your notebook. The work group and the commission, in the spirit of new directions, have directed us to reorganize the department and rethink our delivery of all our programs to make it more integrated, more responsive to communities, and to direct a greater share of our resources to rural and distressed communities. We have understood that direction, and they've made it clear that that direction applies to the Community Development Block Grant as well as to our other programs, and the reason for the delay is simply that we've taken the time to revise our approach to all our programs, and including that program, and we are, in addition to, and we concluded that we didn't have time to do the extent of analysis that's required to improve the housing rehabilitation program in the way we'd like to, but much as the last legislature did with some of our other programs, we decided to keep the program alive, but to reduce its scale a little in the meantime, because we're dissatisfied with the, I guess I'd say, the return on investment that we're getting there compared to what we could be getting. And we believe, in the spirit of new directions and partnership with the other agencies, that it's really the housing department that ought to be leading this analysis. So we've set up that plan. The main change we've made really involves the delivery system for the community services portion of the financing, and that's what's been really mainly responsible for the delay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes. I'm very concerned that you don't have the data before you about the cost effectiveness of doing it by rehabilitation versus building new buildings. And I'm also concerned that you're really not being consistent. On the one hand, you want local interest. On the other hand, you want to eliminate advisory committee that's made up of local input. So, well, I just like to see you have some data you can give to us to see what you use as a base to make your recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think I've explained our rationale as well as I can. We agree with your conclusion. I don't have data, but this has been told to me by Director Refine, and I believe him, that rehabilitation is a more cost-effective way to go than new construction. Our department doesn't do new construction, and I know he's trying to redirect his resources in that same direction you are, so we certainly agree with your conclusion, and I have no doubt that the data support it.
We'll see what they have.
Okay. Ms. Lamont, did you have a question or a comment to make?
No, I didn't. I did. we're planning on continuing until about 10:30, so if you want to make sure that you get your pieces in.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, if you'd like to change anything, Lamont.
The last part of it is kind of a light part, but something that I've brought to the legislature because people bring it to me to show me how bad the water systems are or to make their point about why they need this money. And this piece of pipe here, this is wood safe pipe, which fell apart in the back of my car this morning. But if a hole, it would be round. It was in the city of Astoria system, put in 1905 and taken out last year. Yeah, 2 years ago. The good news is if the pipe stays wet and under a lot of water pressure, it works just fine, but when it gets dry or it starts leaking, then all sorts of critters and things can get into that pipe. And this is not just typical of Astoria, but we're seeing a lot of it. We're taking out all over. The last improvements were made 95 years ago. Here's a case. This is water. This is water with red dye in it, but the story is a facsimile. The people were asking us to fund a sewer treatment plant because the septic tanks were failing and there was water in the backyard, wastewater in the backyard, so they're making their point that they needed a sewer system. Well, so they flushed red dye down the toilet of a house to show that the red dye would come out in the backyard and showing they had a real problem out there. While they were waiting for the red dye to come outside, one of them asked for a drink of water, and the red dye came out of the drinking water system. They got the money. I'm not going to tell you where it was. I don't have any illustrations of nitrates, but your point is well taken. Nitrates cannot be boiled out of the water or taken out by any treatment, and they cause blue babies, and you can't give it to children. They have a daycare center over there that they have to bring in bottled water because it's so clear. This is Monmouth, where a lot of people go to school, and this is asbestos cement pipe. And just the natural minerals in their water system has been eroding that asbestos cement pipe for years. They have 18 miles of this stuff to replace, and they found a temporary a remedy for that, but pretty soon they're going to have a big expense. I should point out that to replace that, 10-inch pipe, we're talking about $60 a foot for a ductile iron pipe, $60 a foot, so a 100-foot lot is about $6,000 if you do that. And I then wanted to point out that even in the city of Portland, where they have the very finest water that requires little treatment, they have such things as these little things that get into the water that need filtering out. This is a baby lamprey eel, and when I was up in the Bull Run system in one of their laboratories, they have big lamprey eels that get into their system. My point is that a lot of stuff goes into the water systems from the where they get their source, the lakes, the streams, and the underground aquifers. We have to drink that stuff, so a lot of treatment is required. After we drink that, a lot of treatment is required before it's dumped back into the lakes, rivers, streams, and aquifers. And the treatment is probably the biggest cost. So,
I think I saw, Mr. Chair, I think I saw one of those bottles of the lamprey eel on it down in Tijuana one time.
Unfortunately,
that was the worst.
Almost all.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was lamprey eel. I recognize
it. It has special flavors of tequila that were. I'm sorry.
I think that completes my testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Schrader.
Within all, it begs the question, obviously, a lot of needs out there, but how do you prioritize within each of these categories, the wastewater, the special works, the community facilities, which communities get the dollars and which communities do not?
We do business all year round, and we do it on a first-come, first-basis. Almost all the programs, with the exception of the public works, have compliance issues. So first they have to have a compliance problem, like we're talking about there. And then when they're ready, they're on such a different basis. Sometimes they have to go to the voters for approval to repay the bond. Sometimes they're ready to go. Sometimes they need engineering. So as they come in with a problem, sometimes they only know that the well went dry and they don't know what to do about it. We'll set them up with grant or loan funds to hire an engineer to solve the problem. Then when they get that done, they come back in for construction funding. So it's as long as the money lasts, we just treat them first come, first serve.
Yes, please. So the, $2.8 billion is just kind of a general list of things they think they're going to be needing, but their local communities are not really ready for all these yet. And number two, you don't really loan money to do the projects. You loan seed money to help them get towards the project, much like you were talking about earlier with the community facility.
Representative Schrader, we do both. There are some communities that are so small and so they aren't strong enough to get into the bond market at all. And for those communities, we have to give grants to get their systems operating. If they can afford any loans, and all of our projects are based on an analysis of financial ability to pay. So if they can afford loans, they get loans first, and then we give them grants to finish the project if they need it. But there are many, many communities, especially in eastern southern Oregon, that need all grants. So we're doing three things. We're giving grants, loans, and selling bonds. The bonds are going mostly to the better credit worthy communities that can handle the bonds.
Representative Starr, did you have a question?
Okay.
Just a minute. Were you finished with that?
Yes, I think there's other areas. I mean, in my own, I have some rural areas in my district that aren't in southern or eastern Oregon that also, I think, are qualified for grant programs, and I appreciate the.
All over the state.
Hey, Yvonne, the question I have, and I think would be helpful for the committee, is how much has actually been paid back? If it's a loan, how much has actually been lent out? And how much has been paid back by local government? I've never seen that figure displayed on how much was given to communities or counties or cities, and how much was ever paid back. Do you have those numbers?
I think we could develop those numbers since we started running the program. We have never had a default. All loans have been repaid.
No, I'm not talking about default. I'm just saying, you know, like it's a city of 800 people, and they need a sewer treatment plant upgrade or something, and you lend money for that infrastructure, and they're going to recover it by their rate of return. But they can't charge enough high rates to make forth on the payment. And who else is subsidizing within the infrastructure account meeting the responsibility of paying for those bonds? Because a city of 800 people out in Central Oregon or Southern Oregon cannot afford those high rates that would be required to pay for those bonds. Somebody else is subsidizing that account somewhere, and I want to see what those numbers are.
Meaning the state and federal government subsidizing them. Is that where you're going with
that? Well, I mean, some other city may not be having access to some bonds because the well's dry, using your definition, the well is dry,
So therefore, it's all rent out, and we're not receiving enough money. I'm not talking about defaulting. I'm just talking about meeting obligations.
That's a difficult one to know what the total obligations are, other than this inventory that we've done that show a long list of worthy projects.
Well, if you don't have a list, you would be the poorest banking system that I'm aware of.
It's the list.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we're somehow or other quite understanding each other. What we do have is we know all the loans that the state has made or all the bond sales that the state has organized. Regular payments are being made on all of those. So far, that's not a scarce resource. Anybody that can qualify for the repayment of those bonds or those loans is able to. We've never shut the window on loans for infrastructure projects. If a community can't finance the whole improvement it needs based on its ability to pay, essentially we require them to finance as much as they can, and then either our department or and sometimes they finance that through us, sometimes it's Department of Environmental Quality, or it may be U.S. Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. All three of us can make loans. And then if the loan they can support doesn't get to the project that they need after we've all worked it over and tried to downsize it, then we can make a grant. Rural Development can also make grants. So we can make a grant to close the gap if we can get the gap small enough. We normally won't make a grant larger than $500,000. Rural Development can sometimes make a grant up to several million dollars, and we can make exceptions, but we almost never do because of just fairness considerations. The only scarce resource really is the grant dollar, and really the only communities that have to wait are the ones that have such a big requirement for grant that we can't meet it within our standard $500,000 grant. Essentially, if you can get your project together and you don't need a grant bigger than $500,000, there's no waiting line. So that's the situation. Now, if I haven't answered the question that you have, tell me and we'll try.
I'm
going
to try to rephrase your question.
Okay.
I am City A.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a grant for X amount of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a loan for X amount of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're City B, and you want in on the grant and the loan problem. But you can get the loan, but you can't get the grant. Okay? Are you following me up to this point?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Why can't you get the grant?
Because it's all been granted out.
Okay.
Pardon me?
It's a capacity question, I believe.
Yeah, and I'm trying to find out, I guess I should have asked you, the first time is, how often are you constantly at capacity having other cities and entities coming in? We're sorry it's already been issued out.
Mr. Chad, I tried to just answer that question. The answer is basically, if you can keep your grant requirement inside $500,000, we've never been out of money. But if you have a bigger grant requirement than that, essentially we say we can't help you. Maybe Rural Development can help you, or maybe we need to rethink the project and get a project that's more appropriately sized for your community. And so for exactly the reason you're talking about, if we had a city, and we've got one right now that we've been working with for several years, that has an engineer that has talked them into a great big project that they're wanting several million dollars worth of grant for, if we were to make that grant, then we'd be in the position that you're talking about of having to tell other cities, I'm sorry, the money's all gone because we gave it to Bleep. So that's why we don't do that.
I inserted the city and Representative Patrick my district is in the situation where the engineer is telling the city, you need this very expensive program. My concern is, why should we give to them at the expense of everybody else? And that troubles me a great deal.
Okay.
President Patrick, did you want to ask a question? You had your hand up.
Well, my question was, and probably in addition to capacity, was, is there anything that goes into your, when you're making grants and you're making loans on these infrastructure funds, for looking at the merits of the project in terms of, are there interties with other cities or other communities that there's some shared wastewater treatment or water facilities or other things that go in, go along with this, that of overall cost savings? And unfortunately, I think at times you, just like we talked before with DLCD and everything else, you have to be the mediator sometimes. But I'm just wondering what kind of factor goes into this, because I think there's a lot of turf battles, especially over these kinds of issues that come along, especially in regards to community growth issues when you open up water capacities or sewer capacities or those kinds of things. What happens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, we do value engineering up front when we're talking to the various cities about how they're going to design their systems, and we look for those kind of cost savings. We tell them we do not want you to over-design a system with pipes so big it serves a community of 41,000 when actually your growth limitations are going to be more like 5,000. So we're looking at sizing of the system. We also encourage greatly that the cities look to each other for support for their system, so that you're not building two identical reservoirs 2 miles apart because the city limits divide them. So we see great savings in double use and shared use of the facilities, and we push them toward that. At these one-stop meetings I was describing, where the mayor comes and says the well's dry, Department of Environmental Quality, the Health Division, and Land Use people are there to make those kind of suggestions and point that out. Why don't you go back and try and work this out with another community? And I, for one, have participated in being a small city with the well dry and had to give up my identity to seek City of Portland Bull Run Water, or at least I thought the whole city was going to lose its identity. What it actually did was allowed a solid source of water for the next 20 years, and still you know where the city of Portland is. My point is, we increase in there, but there are a lot of battles over territory. Yeah.
Yes. Then I guess the follow-up question of that would be, one, do you feel like you have has the department ever refused loans or grants based upon the fact of one of these turf battles, in terms of that there was a more logical way to do it and there were some willing parties, or two, if you haven't done that, do you feel like you have the capacity in your administrative rules or by statute to say, no, this is a lot more expensive solution and the state, it's not in the best interest of the state, and you people are either going to have to work it out or we can't give you any additional money. Do you have the ability to do that?
Representative Patrick, I'm not sure that we, if the bottom line came to that, that we would have the legislation to say, no, we think that your plan is really bad, but we hassle them forever before we give them the money. Most recently, you asked for an example, Nehalem, Wheeler, and Manzanita. We have given them a grant to solve a regional problem rather than do a separate one. In one case, one of those communities had come back and said, this doesn't make sense. The other two are working together. Central Point and Ashland, Medford?
Medford
is another one where they
Ashland, Medford is another one.
There's a lot of turbulence, but we have required them to work as well as we can. And there are three or four others that come to mind that I know that we've done them, I just can't identify them for you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patrick, I would say we really try hard not to say no. What we try to say is we don't think we can fund this the way you're proposing it, but if you'll go to work on solving this problem, you know, we can probably do it. And I think we've had good luck bringing people to a more sensible solution. Usually when they want to do something that doesn't make sense, it requires some discretionary thing on our part to give them extra grant or to waive something or something. And so it's kind of like a red flag of, you know, is this a real need here or is this something that they're not solving in a heads up way, because it usually won't conform to the rules if they're going at that way. Now we have plenty of waiver authority in our rules because one size doesn't fit all, but it tends to, you know, put us in the driver's seat in that kind of situation. I would say with the advent of the community solutions field teams, we have a much, I guess I would say, friendlier way to have that conversation than we used to. I think we're doing a much better job of kind of getting down at the community level with the right people to solve the problem.
All right, Mr. Chair. Representative Beck. I just have kind of a process question on these grants. Obviously, you've got $2 billion of wish lists. You're pretty confident you're going to have a raft of requests here. And who makes the decision? Is it the director? Is it the commission? Is it a staff sort of thing? And I'm sure you have criteria. And what is kind of the basic process for approving
Mr. Chairman, I'll give you kind of the big picture, the macro view, and Yvonne is kind of giving you more of the specifics on kind of a case study basis. Essentially, the commission's big point of control is in how much money they're willing to put into one of these line items. Like, if we say we think we need this much in water, wastewater, and then we come back, you know, a few months later and say we need more, they say why, we get in a conversation, they say, you know, are you giving these people more grant than you should, you know, those kind of things. So part of it we really end up regulating by how much money we put in the fund and then what our policies are in terms of, you know, do we require, when we used to say in every case you can't get a grant unless you accept an equal amount of loan. Now, as we try to package more programs with each other, and if we have a separate loan fund in the Safe Drinking Water Fund, we aren't strict about that. That's the way we used to be. So we keep, I guess I would say, tweaking the rules or policies by which we administer in order, if you will, to regulate the flow of projects. I guess I would say the second thing is that the biggest barrier to getting things funded is really getting the projects ready and getting sensible projects ready. I mean, I would say project development is a much, much, much bigger part of this work than project selection, if you will, or kind of final decision making. And you have lots of opportunity in the development process to guide people to develop projects that are fundable. So this isn't, these projects are multi-year projects. They require multi-years of planning and engineering to get there. And so it's not the kind of thing where we have a zillion applications for grants and then we've got to decide which ones we're going to fund. One of the reasons that Yvonne innovated and went to this take them as they come as opposed to the grant cycle thing is because we found we would say, all right, by all the criteria, this one beats that one, but then something would fall apart, and, you know, and then you'd be back to square one, and you would have money sitting around because you hadn't, you know, you were out of your grant cycle, and you couldn't bring somebody else forward. And we've found that this, while people who haven't administered this kind of a first-come, first-served process are always curious as to how do you say no, I think it works. We found it works a lot better than the other way, and that we can tend to keep a continuous flow of projects going and have the discretion to handle really everything when it needs to be handled. And I think that most of the challenges in the process are managing everybody's expectations, making sure we're giving them good information, you know, so that they understand what they have to do to make their project fundable, and that they can. There's lots of local political situations, as you can imagine. In many cases, these people haven't done an improvement for 50 or 100 years. They're paying very low water or sewer rates. They've got a big political problem getting their rates up. We have to work back and forth with them so that they have something they can take to their voters that says the state will do X if you vote, you know, this way. So it's really quite a complex process, and we've tried to make it, if you will, as informal a process and as hands-on, face-to-face a process as we possibly can.
Can you represent a trader?
Two questions or comments, I guess. I'd kind of like to see the criteria or some rough criteria, or if there's some statutory criteria or some rule criteria you do use to allocate the loan or grant money, and then the statutory reference to the community facilities, you know, how you limit it, you're limited just to the loan, you know, helping facilitate loans. And then the whole last part of your comments, though, would seem to beg, why do you need $55 million? If you've never refused a loan and you do all the grants except if they're huge amounts, why do we need $55 million
more? Mr. Chairman, Representative Spear, I'm glad you asked that question. First of all, the $55 million, let me kind of go back into what the components of it are. $10 million of it is for deepening the Columbia River Channel, so it's basically $45 million for infrastructure. Of that, $20 million is essentially to continue operations at the present level, and that has two pieces to it. One is that I guess I would say we have in the previous biennium, if you look at page 4, we put not quite $10 million in the water, wastewater, and special public works funds. And the
Is this just a roll call or a bill? Let's take about 2 minutes and try to get your answer, because we're not coming back to revisit this. We have to move on to the budget.
Okay. So first of all, I will provide the references that you asked for. We'll provide that Monday. The essentially $20 million of it is to maintain operations, and that is essentially to convert about $10 million in current service level to provide regional strategy, to restore regional strategies, which you didn't do before. So essentially we're bonding that instead of taking it from current service level, because the governor only wanted us to bond the infrastructure portion of the budget. So essentially we're bonding all our infrastructure. So $10 million of it is just to replace current service level. Then there's a second $10 million that is to replace. Last time we had so little money in our budget that what we did was to spend down the balances in the funds. So there's essentially $10 million to, we can't do that a second time. So there's that's basically $20 million to keep doing what we're doing and restore regional strategies. Is that $20 million. Then the other $20 million is an actual increase in infrastructure funding, and that's, as Yvonne said, that theoretically, based on this list, there's a $100 million gap. This $20 would cover $20 of that. I think that's our estimate for the same reasons you're talking about the amount that we're really very confident that there's enough in the pipeline that we can actually make happen. And that's really because the pipeline has been growing. We and our federal partners have done a lot in the last few years, more technical assistance to communities, and then so more design projects that are in line for construction and so on. So there's definitely a ramping up there. The last piece of it is the $5 million is this match for the new Safe Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund that just began this biennium. essentially what that does is create a source of another source of loan funds that partly relieves the water wastewater fund of having to make loans, so it can be used more for grants and less for loans. But it also opened up a whole new market, because our existing lottery funded programs only can do cities, basically, whereas private water systems, that's right. We can only do public cities and public water districts. There are a lot of private water systems that are kind of cooperative systems, basically, that have not been eligible for our funds, that are eligible for the new Safe Drinking Water Fund funded by the Environmental Protection Agency. So we have some new demand that wasn't there before.
Just to paraphrase again, this restores your sinking fund to make it sort of whole for the foreseeable future, except for new federal mandates or, you know, some big new things coming in the pipeline. This gets your agency whole again, so to speak.
It gets us whole, and I think it enables us to meet the increasing demand, and like we say, we can document a theoretical $100 million that we could ask you for, but we think 20 is a more realistic estimate of what we can actually put on the street in terms of ready-to-go projects.
Thank you.
All right, if there's no other discussion before us, we are adjourned until 8 a.m. Monday.